you're tuned to Truth News Radio on the 23rd of April, 2016. Welcome to the show. In today's show, I'm going to be giving you an excursion into an area that I've never talked about before on this show. It's one that, like a lot of the things I talk about, I feel that there is a misrepresentation and a misunderstanding about what is really going on. And, you know, often what I cover in this show is misinformation from the mainstream media. But this is a topic that actually has a lot of misrepresentations in the alternative media as well. It's a murky, dark topic, and it goes by the name of satanic ritual abuse. That particular term encompasses a large number of cases going back to the early 1980s where people claim to have been involved in or been victims of satanic cults that involve a whole variety of quite evil and depraved behavior, including sacrifices and dismemberment and all manner of gruesome acts, often with satanic paraphernalia, and often done in the context of very ordinary day-to-day situations, schools, churches, and practiced by people who look like they're very normal and fine, upstanding people. Of course, this is a theme that also has a lot of echoes in horror films, such as Rosemary's Baby, which was a very popular film in the late 1960s. And indeed, some of the early scandals or accusations regarding satanic ritual abuse appear to have had a more of a kind of a fiction basis than actually being based in any real facts. There is a lot of information on this, and I'm going to provide some links to you on the show notes because I can't really cover it all. It's far too complex. But there's one particularly good documentary made by an alternative researcher, Keelan Balderson, in the UK, and I'll provide you a link to that because he actually goes through the history of some of these very, very dubious accusations that led into major scandals and in many cases criminal prosecutions in the 1980s and 90s, and which at their root really had people who were not genuine, people who were marketing the satanic ritual abuse theme via books and making money out of it, but which led to what they call a moral panic, which is a kind of a situation where people become very, very obsessed and absorbed with the belief that there is a terrible threat, and they see that threat everywhere. It's a bit like the anti-communism sort of witch hunts of the 1950s, or indeed the Salem witch hunts of the 17th century, which is the origin of the use of that word, witch hunt. The witch hunts that took place in relation to satanic ritual abuse were quite serious indeed for those who were charged. Many individuals were charged. Some people went to jail. But in the end, none of these cases were substantiated, and most of the convictions, I think, were overturned, and people were set free after being in prison for many years in some cases. And since then, a body of literature has developed out of the analysis of this from a psychological perspective, and people who analyze this have come up with terms such as false memory syndrome to describe the psychological process by which memories can actually become implanted in people, memories of things that didn't actually exist. And I'm going to be playing to you one audio clip today from Elizabeth Loftus, who is a psychologist who pioneered some of the research into this. And her research definitely proves that false memories can exist. And I think it's important, you know, you've got to go back to the sources. You've got to look at the research that was done. You'll find a lot of websites these days in the current wave of this, which has really had a resurgence in the last few years. You'll find alternative researchers denying that false memory syndrome is real and saying that that was all made up as a cover, that you know, the people who claim this are all part of the cover-up. And this becomes the grand conspiracy theory, which also kind of justifies and explains why, for example, there is never any corroborating evidence, because they say, oh, well, those who are practicing these cults are so good at covering everything up because they control everything. And, you know, why are there no witnesses that come forward to corroborate another witness's statement? Ah, because the church or the organizations involved has everyone paid off, and so no one dares to speak out. But then we do find here and there one person speaks out. But we hear terrible stories about what these people do to their victims. And yet quite often these people who speak out don't seem to get murdered. You know, they continue to exist and they continue to say the things they're saying and put out books or whatever. You think, well, if these satanic cults were really as utterly depraved and evil as they are, and, you know, here you are making these extraordinary accusations and allegations, surely they would have silenced you by now, make you have an accident, you know, make it look like an accident. That's just one argument against it. But there's a lot more that we can say about it, because the main problem with this whole body of media and content and books and discussion groups around satanic ritual abuse has this characteristic of not being verifiable. And this is something you really do have to bear in mind, because if you want to have a scientific appraisal of the world, which, you know, science is our only really solid way of finding out what is and what is not, the scientific method. If you approach this with a scientific perspective, the complete lack of evidence for this particular set of allegations is extremely problematic. Because, you know, there have been many pedophile rings exposed. There have been many cases of pedophilia going up to high levels within government and various organizations. And many of those have been exposed. And when they are exposed, lots of evidence comes together to confirm and corroborate what one witness might be saying here and another witness might be saying there. But in the case of satanic ritual abuse, that never happens. But we have witnesses who make claims that do seem to be similar to other claims, but there is no direct connection. They're just isolated instances where people describe a set of sort of behaviours, phenomena, that correspond to a set of behaviours or phenomena that was described by someone else, maybe in another country. And often people who follow this consider that as evidence. They say, well, look, no, there is evidence because we've got these different people saying the same thing. But here's the problem. The phenomenology of so-called satanic ritual abuse has been popularized since the 1980s. There are books about it. There's massive amount of information about it. And the basic paraphernalia and the basic activities that go by that name are widely available in popular culture. So the claim that, you know, two people in different locations who are describing the same thing, that actually constitutes evidence, falls flat, because the information is in the popular culture. And when we combine that with the fact that we know, as we'll be explaining in this show, that people can develop false memories, then quite clearly, Occam's razor is a principle that we should apply, that the simplest explanation is probably the most likely one to be real. And in the absence of evidence, and when the claims are as extraordinary and improbable as many of these satanic ritual abuse allegations are. And look, I'm not going to go into too much of the detail of this today, because a lot of them, and some of the stuff that's appeared in Australia recently, is extremely controversial and highly inflammatory and defamatory. And I don't want to be in the role of repeating defamatory allegations. So I'm really talking about it more from a perspective of the phenomenon. And you can get all the details if you want and you search, and I'll provide a few links to get you going. But, you know, it's all out there. And there are just the most hideous crimes, apparently, being committed, according to some of these high-profile witnesses. And some of this has come from the UK as well. And some of it's coming from the United States. So I'm not going to detail the exact nature of the crimes, but believe me, they are pretty blood-curdling. But what I'm going to do in today's show is try and kind of triangulate to get a perspective on this where you can see that there is a big problem of factual verification with this whole body of so-called phenomena. And I'm going to propose to you several different ways in which, or mechanisms by which, people end up promoting false narratives. There's a couple of different angles on this, and I'm going to provide some videos that that explain some of that. The most widely known and understood aspect of this is what they call recovered memory therapy. And recovered memory therapy basically does involve people who have some sort of psychological trauma or some sort of psychological problem that then gets revealed to be as the result of a trauma through therapy. And during the course of that therapy, they remember things, and they might be remembering things that happened decades ago when they were small children. And this becomes the basis of many of the allegations of satanic ritual abuse. But I believe there's more to it than that, because I believe there's also an element among some people, and particularly the ones who sort of get in the spotlight, get a lot of attention, and write books, you know, achieve a level of fame. I think there's more of a personality disorder involved in some of those who actually promote this material to that extent. Indeed, one of the first books that started the whole craze of satanic ritual abuse was called Michelle Speaks, and this book was actually proven to be fraudulent. And that was published in the 80s. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio Australia, and I'm talking about this vexed topic of satanic ritual abuse today. And let me just qualify this by saying that, you know, abuse is a terrible thing, and I've interviewed on my show victims of real abuse that really took place and in government institutions, and I think it's very important that it's exposed, and I intend to keep doing that. But the claims we're talking about today are a particular subset of the abuse allegations, and they are the most weak in terms of proof, but they tend to be the most sensational and get the most attention because they're so exotic and incredible. But I think this is quite damaging to the real cause of truth and justice. It's undermining the work of people who were responsible for bringing about the current Royal Commission into institutional sexual abuse, and are still trying to get justice and reconciliation for what happened to them. And these particular people are proven, and the evidence is very clear, and much of it is quite appalling. And I'm very, very, very much behind those who are truly victims of any type of abuse or sexual abuse or pedophilia. But the pursuit of these sensationalized claims by people who appear to be mentally unbalanced or perhaps confused does not aid the truth in any way. Now, just before the break there, I was talking about a book. I misrepresented the title. It's actually Michelle Remembers. And reading from Wikipedia here, Michelle Remembers is a book published in 1980. And it was a bestseller. And it was the first book written on the subject of satanic ritual abuse. And it is an important part of the controversies beginning in the 1980s regarding satanic ritual abuse and repressed memory. The book has been discredited by several investigations which found no corroboration of the book's events, while others have pointed out that the events described in the book were extremely unlikely and in some cases impossible. Now, if you watch the documentary made by Brendan Keelan, which I'm posting on the website, you'll be able to get into more details there, and you'll be able to see that the author of this book really, and I will call it a narcissistic type personality, because I think that is at the root of some of what is going on here, and it is a particular sort of narcissistic personality that engages in confabulations to get attention, but often with financial gains as well. People who perpetuate hoaxes for their own benefit are, I believe, people who have a particular type of personality disorder, which is well described by narcissism and narcissistic confabulation. And this needs to be considered in addition to the very real and perhaps more genuine claims made by people under hypnosis or therapy that they have remembered things that happened when they were young. Now, some of these may be true, some of them may be false, but in most cases, these people are not deliberately out to deceive. But I think it's very important. You've got to understand that some people, by a quirk of their personality, a quirk of their nature, like to deceive people. It's very, very common. Pathological liars are everywhere throughout our society, and they often end up being scammers, con artists, religious cult leaders, or they often end up writing controversial books that make claims that are not real, which gets them a lot of attention. And I want to now play to you a video by the infamous internet personality Sam Vakunin, who is himself described as a narcissist and a psychopath, and has been sort of analysed and diagnosed as such. But he has a website where he gives you his insights into this particular type of personality disorder. And the video I'm going to play to you is specifically about narcissistic confabulation. And it's very, very interesting. So we'll play that, and I'll return with some more comments after this.
My name is Sam Vakunin, and I'm the author of Malignant Self-Love, Narcissism Revisited. We all indulge in confabulating from time to time. Father's wartime heroism, mother's youthful good looks, one's oft-recounted exploits, erstwhile alleged brilliance, past purported sexual irresistibility. They're all typical examples of confabulations. White, fuzzy, heartwarming lies wrapped around a shriveled kernel of truth. But the distinction between reality and fantasy is never lost. Deep inside, the healthy confabulator knows where facts end and wishful thinking or a rewriting of history begin. Father acknowledges he was not really a war hero, though he did his share of fighting. Mother understands she was no ravishing beauty, though she may have been attractive. The confabulator realizes that his recounted exploits are overblown, his brilliance exaggerated, and his sexual irresistibility only a myth. Such distinctions never rise to the surface because everyone, the confabulator and his audience, have a common interest to maintain the confabulation. To challenge the integrity of the confabulator or the veracity of his confabulations is to threaten the very fabric of family and or society. Human intercourse is built around such entertaining deviations from the truth. But this is where the narcissist differs from others, from normal people. The narcissist's very self is a piece of fiction, concocted to fend off hurt and pain and to nurture the narcissist's grandiosity. The narcissist fails in his reality test. He is unable to distinguish the actual from the imagined, the real from the fantasized. The narcissist fervently believes in his own infallibility, brilliance, omnipotence, omniscience, heroism, and perfection. He doesn't dare confront the truth and admit it, not even to himself. Moreover, the narcissist imposes his personal mythology on his nearest, dearest, and closest. Spouse, children, colleagues, friends, neighbors, and sometimes even perfect strangers must abide by the narcissist's narrative or face his rage and wrath. The narcissist countenances no disagreement, no alternative points of view, no criticism.
Okay, I'll just pause it there. This analysis of the narcissistic personality in relation to confabulation can be applied to a lot of different types of people who become very prominent, as I was saying, cult leaders, people who also might engage in confidence tricks, scammers, or on a larger scale, people who are out to deceive, and even possibly politicians going right up to the top. But what's important to understand is that there is this personality type. It does exist, and telling lies and, you know, being deeply embedded in the lie to the extent that it actually is part of you is the way it operates. So when people say to me, and I've had people say, you know, oh, I believe these ritual satanic abuse claims because, you know, no one would make that sort of thing up. Watch the whole of the Sam Vaknin video, and I'll put the link on there because he goes into this in more detail. But indeed, people do make these things up. Maybe you don't. You're not the type of person who does. But there are people out there who actually do make things up. And we've really got to be less gullible. We've got to be less naive. And that's where we come back to this point about evidence, you know, empirical research, truth. If you're really concerned about truth and justice, stick with facts. Don't just go with vague feelings that someone must be telling you the truth because you don't think they would lie to you. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. And my topic today is satanic ritual abuse. But I'm approaching this topic from a very lofty perspective. I'm not really getting into much detail in this show. I may in a later show go into more details. But I'm trying to get a handle on the psychological angle here. I mean, obviously, I'm not a believer in this. I mean, you can obviously glean that. And the reasons why are very similar to why I'm not a believer in, for example, chemtrails. Why I'm not a believer in some of the more fringe theories about 9/11 truth. And it all centers on the lack of evidence. I don't rule things out in principle just because they're so shocking or, you know, sensational or controversial. I don't say, oh, that can't be real. You know, people wouldn't do that. That's not the way I operate. I look for evidence. And then if I find evidence, like really good verifiable factual evidence, then I tend to go with that. If I don't find evidence, I still don't completely rule it out, but I look at the other possibilities. I look at it from different angles. And in this case, and I think this actually does pertain to some of the people who promote chemtrails and some of the people who have promoted some of the extreme 9/11 theories, I see the operation of a, what we might call a deluded state of mind, and I see people who might be described as having some kind of personality disorder, heavily involved and very, very self-righteously proclaiming the truth of what they're saying and often getting quite angry and aggressive in the way they promote it. And we certainly do see that with satanic ritual abuse. But there is another angle to this which I want to present to you now, which is that recovered memory therapy is real. And as the psychiatrist who you're about to hear from, Colin Ross, says, it is actually sometimes therapeutically valuable even when the purported recovered memories aren't real or can't be verified as real. But I think that actually introduces problems into society when you allow this type of therapy to occur, where you take the perspective that you're neutral about the veracity of the information. It becomes a problem because at some point one of your patients is going to say, well, you know, I want justice now. You know, I want to see those people put in prison. And indeed, this is what has happened in the past many, many times. And people have been falsely imprisoned, you know, falsely convicted. And it really does create havoc with society. But let me play to you a little bit about the therapy and the therapeutic aspects of dealing with people who claim to have satanic ritual abuse. Here we go.
I'm Psyche Truth correspondent Karina Rachel, and I'm joined today by Dr. Colin Ross. He is an author and practicing psychiatrist based out of Dallas, Texas. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Well, thank you.
So, Dr. Ross, you published a book about satanic ritual abuse. Can you just tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's a book that I published through the University of Toronto Press in 1995. So it's a mainstream academic publisher. Kind of an odd title for an academic press, though. And the reason I published that book was I moved from Canada to the U.S. late 91, and I had been at a few conferences where U.S. mental health professionals were talking about all this satanic ritual abuse they were hearing about. Meanwhile, I wasn't hearing about it in Canada. Then when I moved to the U.S., especially in 92, 93, it started to settle down, 94, 95, a large number of people coming to my inpatient treatment program were describing growing up in satanic cults, where they were, it was their dad was usually the high priest. They were taken to many, many ceremonies where there's pentagrams and altars and goblets and chanting and all the paraphernalia you'd expect, ritualized sex and sacrifice of babies and children. So there's many, many, many people in the early to mid-90s describing these kind of backgrounds. So I thought, well, now what? Because, of course, there's no academic literature about it. Nobody's ever published a treatment series. Nobody's ever investigated it to see how much of it is real. There's no training on it. There's no standards. Mm-hmm. So the basic gist of the book is, okay, you're a mental health professional. You don't have the ability or the resources or the social obligation to go out and try and investigate something that either did or didn't happen 30 years ago and prove that it did or didn't happen.
Right.
You got to try and help this person who's suicidal, depressed, has multiple personalities. So the basic idea of the book is, here's a way to approach a treatment where you don't have to decide if the memories are all real, not real at all, or some mix in between. And that was the basic theme of the book.
Right, because certainly it's going to be very difficult to verify whether or not something happened that long ago. So can you talk a little bit more about what your findings were once you started looking into it?
Well, I looked into it in the sense of there's only a very small number of books to read, some of them by Christian fundamentalists who are very, you know, invested in the war on Satan and what all the Satanists are doing in America. One FBI report, a couple of other reports that are a little bit more objective and professional, but there really wasn't much literature at all.
Mm-hmm.
And the more I listened to people's stories, talked to them, listened to people's stories, maybe the therapist would make a couple of phone calls to try and investigate a little bit. You could never get a handle on any reality.
Mm-hmm.
Completely different from my experience with investigating CIA military mind control, where the more I looked into it, the bigger and bigger the pile of documents became. And so since you could never get a handle on, okay, here's one example where it's proven that this happened, that brought me back to, okay, now what am I going to do in treatment when I know I can't prove it, and equally as much I can't disprove it.
Mm-hmm. So what would be your estimate of how common something like that would be, or how many people are affected just based on your personal experience?
My estimate, and this is, I'm being totally serious, my estimate is I have no idea.
Okay.
And I don't think anybody on the planet really knows for a fact. People have all kinds of attitudes. So there's people at one end of the spectrum thought, oh yeah, there's tons of it going on. In the early 90s, one guy said 50,000 babies are being killed by Satanists in America every year, which is obviously absurd. The other extreme is we know for sure zero of it's going on. But nobody actually, in fact, knows for sure zero is going on. And if you just think for a second, look at all the witches that were killed by the Catholic Inquisition. Look at all the things that the Nazi Holocaust did. Look at all kinds of barbarities around the world throughout human history. There's nothing that is being described that's out of the norm for the horrible murder, mayhem, and torture that human beings perpetrate each other.
Right.
The costumes are a little unusual, but that's it. So it's not unbelievable that people could be doing things like that. And if you think of the fact that child pornography is a multi-billion dollar industry in the United States, what are the odds that zero pedophiles have ever gotten organized and decided to have a group sex scene where there was kind of satanic costumes? And that 30 years later, somebody says, I was involved in satanic ritual abuse.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so it doesn't seem totally unbelievable to me at all.
Okay, well, I'll just leave it there. That interview is quite interesting. It gets into a lot more detail. His perspective, I think, is very reasonable. Obviously, he doesn't really have a great belief in the validity of most of the claims that are made in therapy, although, as he says, some elements of it may be true, and I would agree with that. But if you watch the full interview, you'll see he goes into a lot more detail describing how it is beneficial and therapeutic to the patient, the individual with a psychological problem, to relive these memories regardless of whether they were real or not. Now, in the next video clip I want to play for you, we actually get into some of the very, very complex and very problematic aspects of what happens when people do have recovered memories or have memories basically implanted in them, which is something that that it has been alleged occurs in the therapeutic situation, is that the therapist can actually implant memories. And the next video clip actually demonstrates some of that and demonstrates some of the real problems with it and why we should be very, very cautious and skeptical about such claims. We'll be right back after this break on the Truth News Radio.
What happens in terms of creating wars is a mind manipulation technique called problem reaction solution. And it works like this. First of all, you create the problem, but you get someone else to be blamed for it. You then report that problem through the media in the way you want it reported. You get the public to react to your problem by saying, something must be done, this can't go on, what are they going to do about it?
Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. Talking about satanic ritual abuse today and talking about some of the psychological angles on it. And I'm now going to play to you a clip from a TED talk by one of the most important researchers in the area of false memory. Her name is Elizabeth Loftus. And her lecture here gets into a lot of aspects of this and really highlights some of the problems from a legal perspective, from a perspective of how we manage society, when you start to understand that a lot of what people believe is a memory is actually not real. And her research is pretty conclusive, and she goes into some of it in detail, and there's a lot more of it that you can find easily on the internet. And to me, it's pretty convincing. You know, what we believe in as memory is not as stable or solid as what we think it is. And this is particularly important for those who adhere to this strict belief in people who make extraordinary claims based on memories, sometimes memories going back to very early childhood. I believe such people who believe that implicitly are a little bit ignorant of the research and the facts. And, you know, if you read just too much of the stuff from alternative media, from sites like davidicke.com, you will probably just have a very, very warped perspective of what is true. But, you know, I get my information from some of those sources too. Not all of it's bad. It's just that you get a very, very biased point of view. And part of what I'm trying to do with Truth News Radio is to expose misinformation and disinformation and bias. And, you know, we have to apply that to the alternative media as much as we do to the mainstream media. So let me play to you now some of this clip from Elizabeth Loftus talking about the fiction of memory. A very interesting talk. Here we go.
I'd like to tell you about a legal case that I worked on involving a man named Steve Titus. Titus was a restaurant manager. He was 31 years old. He lived in Seattle, Washington. He was engaged to Gretchen, about to be married. She was the love of his life. And one night, the couple went out for a romantic restaurant meal. They were on their way home, and they were pulled over by a police officer. You see, Titus's car sort of resembled a car that was driven earlier in the evening by a man who raped a female hitchhiker. And Titus kind of resembled that rapist. So the police took a picture of Titus. They put it in a photo lineup. They later showed it to the victim. And she pointed to Titus's photo. She said, "That one's the closest." The police and the prosecution proceeded with a trial. And when Steve Titus was put on trial for rape, the rape victim got on the stand and said, "I'm absolutely positive that's the man." And Titus was convicted. He proclaimed his innocence. His family screamed at the jury. His fiance collapsed on the floor sobbing, and Titus is taken away to jail. So what would you do at this point? What would you do? Well, Titus lost complete faith in the legal system. And yet he got an idea. He called up the local newspaper. He got the interest of an investigative journalist. And that journalist actually found the real rapist, a man who ultimately confessed to this rape, a man who was thought to have committed 50 rapes in that area. And when this information was given to the judge said Titus free. And really, that's where this case should have ended. It should have been over. Titus should have thought of this as a horrible year, a year of accusation and trial, but over. It didn't end that way. Titus was so bitter. He'd lost his job. He couldn't get it back. He lost his fiancée. She couldn't put up with his persistent anger. He lost his entire savings, and so he decided to file a lawsuit against the police and others whom he felt were responsible for his suffering. And that's when I really started working on this case, trying to figure out how did that victim go from that one's the closest to I'm absolutely positive that's the guy. Well, Titus was consumed with his civil case as he spent every waking moment thinking about it. And just days before he was to have his day in court, he woke up in the morning, doubled over in pain, and died of a stress-related heart attack. He was 35 years old. So I was asked to work on Titus's case because I'm a psychological scientist. I study memory. I've studied memory for decades. And if I meet somebody on an airplane, this happened on the way over to Scotland. If I meet somebody on an airplane and we ask each other, what do you do? What do you do? And I say, I study memory. They usually want to tell me how they have trouble remembering names, or they've got a relative who's got Alzheimer's or some kind of memory problem. But I have to tell them, I don't study when people forget. I study the opposite, when they remember. When they remember things that didn't happen or remember things that were different from the way they really were. I study false memories. Unhappily, Steve Titus is not the only person to be convicted based on somebody's false memory. In one project in the United States, information has been gathered on 300 innocent people, 300 defendants who were convicted of crimes they didn't do. They spent 10, 20, 30 years in prison for these crimes, and now DNA testing has proven that they're actually innocent. And when those cases have been analyzed, three-quarters of them are due to faulty memory, faulty eyewitness memory. Well, why? Like the jurors who convicted those innocent people and the jurors who convicted Titus, many people believe that memory works like a recording device. You just record the information, then you call it up and play it back when you want to answer questions or identify images. But decades of work in psychology has shown that this just isn't true.
Just pause it there. I just want to reflect on the point that she's making in regard to some claims that have been made in Australia recently that high-profile politicians, very well-known people, in some cases ex-prime ministers, were involved in horrific acts based on memories or identification of people going back several decades. And what Elizabeth Loftus here is saying is extremely important. Really, you do need to think about this, because the ability of the human brain to get it wrong is quite extreme. So, as she showed there in those statistics, and imagine trying to identify a face of someone that you saw when you were 6 years old, and that you never saw again except you've seen that person in the news or in the media, but your memory is telling you that you saw that person in a particular context when you were 6 years old. Consider how viable really is that. Anyway, let's continue.
Our memories are constructive. They're reconstructive. Memory works a little bit more like a Wikipedia page. You can go in there and change it, but so can other people. I first started studying this constructive memory process in the 1970s. I did my experiments that involved showing people simulated crimes and accidents and asking them questions about what they remember. In one study, we showed people a simulated accident, and we asked people how fast were the cars going when they hit each other. And we asked other people how fast were the cars going when they smashed into each other. And if we asked the leading smash question, the witnesses told us the cars were going faster. And moreover, that leading smashed question caused people to be more likely to tell us that they saw broken glass in the accident scene when there wasn't any broken glass at all. In another study, we showed a simulated accident where a car went through an intersection with a stop sign, and if we asked a question that insinuated it was a yield sign, many witnesses told us they remember seeing a yield sign at the intersection, not a stop sign. And you might be thinking, well, you know, these are filmed events. They're not particularly stressful. Would the same kind of mistakes be made with a really stressful event? In a study we published just a few months ago, we have an answer to this question. Because what was unusual about this study is we arranged for people to have a very stressful experience. The subjects in the study were members of the U.S. military who were undergoing a harrowing training exercise to teach them what it's going to be like for them if they are ever captured as prisoners of war. And as part of this training exercise, these soldiers are interrogated in an aggressive, hostile, physically abusive fashion for 30 minutes. And later on, they have to try to identify the person who conducted that interrogation. And when we feed them suggestive information that insinuates it's a different person, many of them misidentify their interrogator, often identifying someone who doesn't even remotely resemble the real interrogator.
And that's where we'll have to leave it today. That talk is really excellent, and I suggest you watch the full thing. A lot of what she's saying there is very relevant to therapy and the way in which therapists can actually inject or implant false memories into subjects, and this is something she actually does discuss in relation to satanic ritual abuse allegations, which she was involved in researching. We may return to this subject in future shows, but I hope you found this little primer today of some value. I'll be back next week with Truth News Radio. See you then.